in there, guys. The Yokudas are coming. They were here a second ago.
They were just here, we swear. In the meantime, I guess we can say we've made our drink. We've made our drink, and
the blue blazer.
I decided I don't care for blue curacao.
It's all right. These are all like any recipe. They're all just a starting point.
Oh, it tastes like NyQuil. Come back.
Come back, Okudas. They were back. There, and then they
were gone. Mike and watch Denise, come back.
People are like, yeah, right. You guys didn't really have them.
How did I do this last week that I could see the comments and at the same time?
I'm going to put up the drink. So there it is. This is what I'm drinking, guys. One part vodka, quarter part blue curacao, and ginger beer. It's on the website if you want to see it. Stop sharing. So we are going to talk about Buckaroo Banzai as soon as the Yakudas come back.
They are all ready to go.
I know.
They had their Buckaroo face masks and their Buckaroo headbands, and she had her Team Banzai jacket. So we are very excited to talk to them as soon as they find that link again.
There they are. They're all ready to go. They're back.
And she had her Team Banzai.
We're just talking about you guys. Somebody needs to mute their the feed so we don't hear it.
I hope that's not me. No, it's not me.
No, I think it must probably them. But anyway, so welcome, guys. Now that everybody's here, we're to Sci-Fi Distilled. I'm Mike and Mary Beth, of course, and we are very, very honored to have Mike and Denise Okuda with us. And if you don't know who those two are, you don't know Star Trek. So where am I going to go in there? Because I know everybody in here knows.
Yeah.
We can see and hear you, but I closed our Facebook page because we're getting some weird echo or something.
Yeah, if you have the web page of the stream open, you need to just kill the audio on that.
How do I just do that?
And then
there should be a sound.
There should be a little speaker down the right corner. You should be able to just kill it to zero, and then you can see the comments. So, welcome everybody.
Here,
Warren, Rob, Garth, Roy.
No, it's okay. Denise, it's okay. I like it.
So Chris, Bruce, Dave,
they're rolling in. So shall we begin?
Yeah, let's begin.
So excited.
1984, a crazy movie was released.
Yep.
The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai in the Eighth Dimension. And that is the official whole title, even though most people just say Buckaroo.
No, it's okay. Denise, it's okay. I like it.
Chris. I think we're still having some technical.
I think we're still getting some feedback, but that's okay. Yeah, I'm so excited.
1984, a crazy movie was released. Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai in the Eighth Dimension, and that is the official.
We're
still hearing your audio.
It's okay. I like it.
But I can't get the text.
Well, it's all right. Mary Beth does a really good job of feeling out the questions. So,
okay.
Let's just move forward.
Go forward.
So,
kill that video.
It's not mine. I don't know if it is.
No, it's theirs.
It's theirs. Okay. Okay. So we know that there are a ton of Buckaroo Banzai references in Star Trek, which is so cool, which means there were other Buckaroo Banzai fans working on Star Trek. And rumor has it, and you guys can confirm for us, rumor has it, there is an oscillation overthruster photograph on the cover. Yes!
There it is.
I knew.
Wow, that's a nice model.
There's a picture of it on the cover of one of the editions of the encyclopedia. Is this true? Yes. That is awesome.
Which is it, the 94 edition?
Could be.
Let me hang on. Mary Beth, take over.
Yeah. We have we We made it a project to put the oscillation overthruster as many places as we could. One of the most prominent ones.
I'd have to get closer. It's
okay. Hell no, he won't see it.
It's tiny. I looked, but I didn't find it. But I just want to know if that's the right edition.
I don't remember. I'd have to.
This is the 94. Anyway, moving on.
Anyway, in first the feature film First Contact, when you go inside Zefram Cochrane's spaceship, they're like right behind the actors. They're like right behind Jonathan. And we saw that in the dailies the next day, and we were like, oh my God, because we usually hide them but they were right there. But it's been
But we put like five overthrusters in that set.
Yeah.
And it's so cool.
We put them so many places. Yeah.
There was one of the last episodes of Star Trek Enterprise was we had with two episodes. We had Peter Weller as a guest star, and we had a whole bunch of really crappy copies of the overthruster, and we had a couple of really nice ones. This is one of the really nice ones. So I went up to LeVar and I said, hey, have you ever heard of Buck Rubin's? I guess, of course. So I said, LeVar, I'll make a deal with you. I will give you one of these if you do a shot where Peter Weller is using one of these. So he said, absolutely. So I handed him the prop, and the prop master happened to be walking by, and he said, the on-set prop master, and he said, LeVar, would you like me to hold on to it until it's time? And LeVar said, no. And he put it in his pocket. So there's actually a shot. You can't see it too well because Weller holds it kind of like this, but he uses it as a remote control. It's in the mining station.
And somebody used it as a medical instrument. I mean, we've used the oscillation overthruster through all the different incarnations of Star Trek, whether you saw it or not, whether it was obvious or not, it was there somewhere. Yeah. It's kind of like our side joke.
Yeah, Greg Jean, who gave us the original copy, did one version where you push the button and this little light blinked on it. So I know Bill Wheaton used it as a geologic tool, or somebody used it as a geologic tool in episode Pen Pals. McCoy used it as a medical instrument in Star Trek V. What else?
Anyway, it's been around.
It's been around.
I guess that's so. Awesome. Who knew that there was? It's probably the most prolific prop of all time.
No, it was in a lot of places.
It was in a lot of places. Some people have found it and recognized it for what it was, and some of those, it just kind of slid under the radar, as they say. So that is so cool that you guys were putting it in everywhere. Can you tell me what was it? I know what I love about Buckaroo Banzai, but what was it about Buckaroo that kind of captured your imagination or made you sort of fall in love with the movie?
Well, big time. It's a universe. It's such a unique and well thought out universe. I fell in love. I went to a convention. This is pre-Mike. I went to a convention and they showed the trailer. And no matter where you go, there you are. And I fell on the floor. And so I saw it the day that it opened, which was August 10th, 1984. In the theater, there was just a smattering of people there. And I just thought it was hilarious. But I went and bought the book, which I will show you, the original book. Then they re-released it. Was just so rich. The universe was so rich in the fact that you could apply to the Institute and it didn't matter who you were, what your past was. If you had a passion and you could follow that passion, then you might be admitted into the Institute. And you could change your name. Obviously, the names are kind of off the wall. And you could go forward. And on their business cards, on one side, it would say, Banzai Institute for Biomedical Engineering and Strategic Information. On the other side was the band, the rock
and roll. Yeah, the Hong Kong Cavaliers.
The Hong Kong Cavaliers. So it's just a fun, funky universe. And it is really, really a shame that Fox basically killed it. They didn't market it. They pushed it down.
They didn't understand it.
And they,
well, I had heard that it was kind of between, there was some regime changes at Fox, and neither one nearly knew what to do with it. Nobody could like define the movie. They didn't know how to market it. At least this is what I've read, and that there was a lot of confusion at Fox, and they were like, what is this? You know, like, we don't know what to do with it now that it's made. You know, it's like, we don't know if is it a comedy? Is it an action movie? Is it a science fiction movie? You know, it was just,
and the answer is yes. There,
and you know, it's kind of, when you think about it, it's a movie that when you're sitting there watching, it's a movie that just doesn't care that you don't understand what's going on. It's just, you're thrown into this universe without a lot of background, and it's just, here it is, and you figure it out.
So, and the figuring out is fun.
That's right. Every time you watch it, you pick up something else that you missed. I missed the watermelon. I don't know how many times.
Well, that watermelon scene is kind of the antithesis of the fact that W.D. Richter, Rick Richter, came out and he told us that, you know, the suits at Fox just had no clue what we were making. And so they would do things like put the watermelon there. And, you know, why is that watermelon there? I'll tell you later. They just threw it in just to kind of confuse the suits. And there was a reason, and we were told later by W.D. Richter and Earl MacRoush, the writer, that Perfect Tommy was working on an experiment in order to drop food into third world countries. And so he was working on a watermelon that would stay intact when dropped from an airplane, because you notice the watermelon's in a vise. Yeah. And so that's why the watermelon was there. The real reason is because they were just so tired of dealing with the suits who did not understand that they would just throw bizarre things in.
I always liked it better that there was no explanation. I love that when people, they just throw stuff in a movie and it's just like, it's just there. There is no explanation. We just put it there to be funny. You know, just because, like you said, it was just there.
Yeah.
We don't know why they put it there.
It's not just that there's no explanation, but obviously everybody in the movie knows exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Just too busy to explain it to you.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there's other examples of that in the movie. There's a lot of things that go on in the movie that are within the universe of the movie, but that have no, like, we don't know what's going on. We don't, like, they mentioned Pecos. Who's Pecos? We don't know. Exactly. It's all in the book. Is that book actually by Earl MacRoush or?
Yes. Yep.
It is. Okay. So he fleshed out his universe. Good for him. Yep.
I had heard that he like had the whole script, but was like in his house or his car or something, and it burned up or something. And then he had to like rewrite it from memory or something. Was that?
Or he lost it or something.
There was something like the original script, and he's like, don't worry about it. I got it all in my head and I'll just rewrite it.
Haven't heard that one, but what we were told was it started out as an idea by Earl MacRoush, and W.D. Richter, amazing filmmaker with an amazing imagination, fell in love with it, and he and his wife Susan basically kept after him for years and years to develop and developed it in all kinds of wacky directions. For a while it was called Strange Case of Mr. Cigars, and then eventually it morphed its way into the Adventures of into Buckaroo Banzai, and only at the last minute, just before it was released, did it become The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. Someone thought that including those extra words would make it make more sense.
Of course.
And of course, there was originally, I thought, at least at the end, they give the implication that there was going to be a sequel. Now, maybe they just did that to be funny, but
They very much wanted to do a sequel.
In fact, all of the actors, there's a long, interesting history between the time that the film was released and bombed, and the fan club that was created and the people that started word of mouth started spreading. There were midnight screenings that were sold out across the country, and they started paying attention to that there might be something here. And Rick Richter, the director, contacted all the actors, and all of the actors were on board. And then some money came from New York, and it was looking like it wasn't going to, that it might be made. But then there was a meeting with David Beagleman, who was at 20th Century Fox. I'm not sure where he was at the time. He's since passed on. He killed himself. But he basically had, did not like the film. And he basically said, "You'll never make another sequel as long as I'm here." And
oh, that's a shame.
That's why it went away.
Wow. It had such massive potential.
It did.
Oh, yeah.
And it's tried to be resurrected.
Right. Kevin Smith, I think, was working on bringing it back as a TV series or something at one point recently.
But even before the last 10 years. But before then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Around 1998, we got a call from Richter. Called us up in the Star Trek art room and said, "Hey, guess what? Polygram had indicated an interest in doing a new pilot." So he and Romac Rausch wrote a Buckaroo Banzai pilot script, which unfortunately was never made, but it was a lot of fun. It was called Supersize Those Fries. It was Turner Buckaroo Banzai with Lord John Worthen harnessing the power of potatoes to try to control the world. Of course.
That's awesome.
What else would you use?
That's so cool. Because Worfen didn't die in the movie, so he absolutely could have been used if they had done it again. And John Lithgow loved the movie.
Would have brought in as Buckaroo, because I think by then Peter Weller probably would have been too old.
98.
Well, I think the thought was that they were going to recast.
They would recast, because he's kind of a young character.
This was made back in 83 and released in 84.
Right.
So they would recast.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm trying to think of who modern would be a good Buckaroo Banzai, and I nothing's coming to mind. Of course, I don't necessarily thought I would have put Peter Weller in there either.
Well,
but it worked. Obviously.
He might be able to be a different character. I mean, you might be able to work him in, but there was a script written. Doug Drexler and the Star Trek art department became the Banzai Institute for a period of time. We built this crate. Gosh, what was in the crate? And it was really fun.
We built this amazing jet car replica. Anthony Fredrickson built a little jet car, put it in his own shipping crate, covered it with Banzai Institute labels, created a fake shipping history for it. It went to NASA, it went to the Smithsonian. It was curated by the Atomic Energy Commission, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And we sent it to Richter's agent to send on to the studio. And was covered with these caution radiation stickers, so they kind of freaked out. They called Richter and said, "We got this radioactive thing here. What do we do with it?"
That's funny.
Doug worked on it. Doug did all kinds of illustrations. I mean, it was quite the thing. It was a script was written. We did, like I said, there were a bunch of illustrations and concept drawings and that we did just for fun. I mean, the Star Trek graphics department became the Banzai Institute. And what are you looking for?
I'm gonna find.
So I'll just say hello to everyone watching. Yeah, I see we've got a lot of good viewers. Guys, if you have questions about Buckaroo Banzai or anything, you guys can type them. Hopefully we'll catch them as they go by, because it's like kind of constantly scrolling and sometimes we have to go back and there's a delay. So if you guys have any questions, feel free to type them out. We'll try to catch them. But it's a shame they didn't But see, it's never, you can never catch lightning in a bottle twice. Like, the first one was just so special. I don't know if you could ever get it again, you know, get that feeling of it again. But
yeah, well, I agree. And the time to do it would have been back in the day, you know, in the 80s, in the late 80s. Yep. But that opportunity was never really possible because of the bureaucracy and the suits at Fox that just didn't get it.
One thing I was noticing, just kind of going back through movies of the 80s, you look at movies like this and Back to the Future and the Indiana Jones series, and they were all so positive in a way that they weren't, I don't know, today it seems like every movie has to have, and TV shows have some kind of agenda, whether it's political or whatever, and social, and I really missed, it seemed like the 80s had this, like, these are just for fun. We're just going to have fun with our movies, and there's no underlying thing, and I wish that kind of would continue modern day. But you know, that's why I was wondering if these type of movies, what I'm getting at is if these type of movies, if they were made today, would have the same impact that they did then.
It would certainly be harder to make them, simply because the style is to be darker, the style is to have tap into to the angst, whereas in the 80s we were more positive. Even back in the 80s, I do think that that Richter and Earl McRoush had I don't know if you want to say political agenda. They certainly had a political point of view. What they were I don't think they were in your face about it, but they certainly had a point of view. And I think that informed the show. Going back a little bit, this was the pilot script that was never made.
It was called,
it was called Buckaroo Banzai, Ancient Secrets and New Mysteries. The episode title was Episode One, Supersize Those Fries.
Is it a good, like, how is it? Is it good? You read it, surely.
It was fun to see our characters, our friends, back again.
Doing things, yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe someday. I don't know.
Well, you know, there's always people making fan films.
There's a jet car taking flight.
Yes. The Ford, the 82 Ford F-350 or whatever it was.
Yeah, it was.
But the one in the 84 film didn't fly.
No, fast in a straight line.
Yeah. It of course featured Dr. Emilio Lizardo.
I loved him telling the story.
Doug did just these brilliant things.
Here's amazing.
Lizardo with the potato energy gun. Another
man, this would have been phenomenal.
This would have been awesome. Because Lizardo was like consuming electricity, so maybe he would need to find an alternative form of power.
It would have been so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were, again, disappointed, but, you know, the original...
The potato gun.
The original publicity when the film was being designed was brilliant. I don't know, you can see this. This is an envelope that was sent out to the press. I love this, Banzai Institute for Biomedical Engineering and Strategic Information. And this was the address, and it says confidential at the bottom. And on the back, there's the official Banzai Institute seal, but there's something that, you know, it was sealed here, but it looks like somebody broke the seal. Yeah.
It was mailed out with the seal broken.
So it looks like somebody went inside. So when you opened up this very cool looking envelope, there's nothing inside. It's completely empty. So then a couple of weeks later, they mailed another letter out and they basically said, "We really apologize. You got these. But Hanoi Shan, which is really detailed in the book, Hanoi Shan got a hold of this stuff, took out the confidential information, and it contained a pass to the press screenings of the film to follow up. So they had a lot of really interesting publicity agendas. Also, Terry Erdman, I don't know if you guys have ever heard, he was the publicist for Buckaroo Banzai, and he went to science fiction conventions taking headbands. They had a ton of headbands made. And I remember he was throwing these out into the audience, and they showed the trailer. And he was going to science fiction conventions, and he was publicizing the film. So they had a lot of really, really cool,
very clever
ideas.
Yeah.
And then when the film didn't do anything, but then Fox kept getting this fan mail, all this fan mail. And I met a woman that worked in publicity by the name of Diane Wicks in 1984 at Worldcon. And she was wearing one of these jackets. I don't know if you can see it.
Team Banzai. Yeah, it says Team Banzai, guys.
Crew jacket. And I went up to her and I said, I love this film. What can we do to bring it back? So Diane and I and a couple other people created this fan club, and we got together at Fox every Sunday and we answered fan mail and we wrote a newsletter and we sent out mailings to everyone that included a headband and a little pin and
a newsletter.
And a newsletter.
Wow.
And a newsletter, several of them. This is another thing we mail out.
Oh my God.
On a newsletter. And our whole goal was not to form a fan club. Our goal was to get people excited, to get possibly some backers, and to make World Crime League. And we came that close.
That is so cool that you did that. Like, that's amazing. You were your own little grassroots movement to get this thing going. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
It was really, really fun. And we got to know the director, Rick Richter, better, and just had a wonderful time. It was really, really fun. Went to midnight.
To quote Kirk, my life that could have been, but wasn't.
It could have been, but wasn't. So Bruce asked, what does Peter Weller think of it? Does he look back fondly? And I'll let you guys think about it. I've seen him do a couple of like conventions or whatever I've been watching on YouTube. And he always introduces the movie with, I don't know what this movie's about. And then afterwards, he speaks very enthusiastically. So I'll let you guys answer, but I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's always very positive about his experience. He just doesn't know what the hell the movie was about.
He doesn't know what the movie's about.
You know, the wacky thing is we worked with him for 2 or 3 weeks on Star Trek Enterprise. And you'd think we'd run up to him and say, hey, but we were so consumed with making the episode that except for that thing with LeVar, I didn't do anything more than say good morning.
Now, Clancy Brown was in another episode of Enterprise in an earlier season. Clancy Brown played Rawhide.
Yeah.
And we weren't as crazed. And so we actually went down to stage and talked to him, and he was lovely. He was, he loved his experience working on the film. We talked to him about it. And that was really fun, and we could kind of geek out a little bit, but he loved it. I mean, he loved the film. He enjoyed the experience, and
good.
So that was fun.
Awesome.
Oh, that's
awesome. Know, it's another point out.
So sounds like he liked it.
Yeah, the Go cast ahead, overall was amazing when you think about who they had cast on it. I mean, you had Jeff Goldblum and, you know, Peter Weller and Christopher Lloyd and John Lithgow, and you know, it just keeps going. It's
Ellen Barkin and
Ellen Barkin at the time, these are all, I mean, it was just an amazing cast for a movie that really was so obscure, kind of, you know. I mean, obviously it's kind of funny, you'd think it would have done just on name recognition alone. I mean, like we were talking about earlier, John Lithgow just came off of The World According to Garp
and Terms of Endearment, I think.
Terms of Endearment. I think he was up for Academy Award for at least one of those.
For both.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing.
There they are. There's the group.
That's
walking in the aqueduct. That's down in the aqueducts, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's from the end credit.
Yeah. Done at Sepulveda Dam, which is very close to our house. They had no idea what they were doing. It was after the film was done. They thought they were doing some publicity. And the original music that they marched to was not the end of the film music, the bonsai music. It was Uptown Girl by Billy Joel.
Yep. Yep.
And I don't know if that's been out on, I think so. But anyway, that was really fun, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was, I did know. The music hadn't been composed yet. Yeah. That's what they, because the music hadn't been done yet.
Yeah.
So that's it's funny, you know, it's, there's so many weird facets to the film. You know, I think, what was it? Weller was saying that, like, you know, when he was doing the scene where he was being tortured, and, you know, and Christopher Lloyd's like in the background, and so they had to do like 50 takes or something, because he's eating Doritos, like he's just cracking up, like this, because Lloyd's making him laugh, and, you know, it's like the you know, the director's getting ticked off because they can't get the line straight, because he's like, I'm just laughing constantly about, because here he is just eating Doritos in the background.
And the scene where Christopher Lloyd finally gets aggravated enough and he kind of flips Lithgow off, and Lithgow turns and he's kissing his helmet. He's kissing the helmet to hide the fact that he's laughing. And if you watch carefully, you can actually see him starting to crack up. Oh, yeah. They just were laughing the whole time.
Yeah, clearly they were enjoying that film.
Clearly they were enjoying that
film. Now, in the book, I have a question, since you're more familiar with it. Why was... what's his name as a cowboy there? Jersey there.
Yeah.
Why was he? I mean, they never explain why he was in a cowboy outfit.
Because he's from Fort Lee. I
don't remember if he hailed from. I think he hailed.
He was from New Jersey, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was from Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, I would understand if he was from Texas or New Mexico or something.
I think the implication was, at least my understanding from the film, and I could be totally wrong, is he knew that the name of the band was the Hong Kong Cavaliers, and he took Cavaliers and said, "Well, of course, I'm going to wear a cowboy outfit."
Well, okay, that makes sense. I didn't know if there was some kind of deep meaning that maybe was explained in the book.
I heard more like the outfit was actually his grandfather's, and his grandfather performed in silent movies in it. But there's so much lore out there, it's hard for me to know what's true and what's not.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all. It's been a long time since I've read the book. I mean, a long time.
And of course, if you talk to McRoush or Richter, they'll tell you absolutely straight face. They'll give you a good answer. And if you ask them a while later, they'll give you a different answer.
Just whatever that comes to the mind at the moment.
But that's really part of the genius of the film. That is, these guys have, and both of them have these wonderful off the wall imaginations. And you ask them a straight question, and they will give you a straight face. They'll give you an utterly absurd answer. But then you think about it and go, oh, actually, that kind of sort of almost slightly makes sense.
Well, the whole movie is just, you know, I mean, like I said, every time you watch it, it makes more sense to me, I guess, is that if that makes sense. It's like, because the first time I saw it in the theater in 84, and I came out of it, I go, I liked it, but I don't really know why I liked it. Like, I was kind of confused. You know, I wasn't like, oh, this is the best movie ever, but I was just like, What did I just sit through? You know, it was kind of like weird.
I liked it because it was yeah, utterly absurd, but it had a wonderful sense of its own absurdity. It would go off totally in a left direction, but then you'd see a little, oh, because of this we do that, and because of this we do that, and then we'll go off in a completely different direction.
Yeah, I mean, I was a fan of Lithgow back then. And certainly that solidified my, you know, fandom of his acting. I think he's really good. I'm really sad that he only really has been doing voiceover work since Third Rock. I mean, he hasn't
But after Banzai, yeah, his character in Third Rock was very much a Banzai-esque character.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, you know, he got, and you guys, I'm sure, know this. He got the accent from the tailor. He was the Italian tailor that he got the accent from. He actually gave the guy a credit as voice coach. Was this tailor got the Italian accent?
The guy that works in costumes.
Yeah, the guy who was like in costume. He was like the tailor. So, but he was obviously an Italian American. He had a heavy Italian accent, and that's how Lithgow got the accent for the part. He actually got the guy the credit. It's the only guy. It's the only credit that he ever has in any movie.
That's funny.
So, thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, if I knew that, I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
Well, this is what Lithgow is telling. I got that right from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, that's what Lithgow says.
And he wouldn't lie.
I'm just checking the comments to see if anybody have any other questions, guys? Just no one else. But all comments, everybody's chatting. Everyone's kind of saying the same things, how much they loved it and how irreverent it could be. But yeah, I'll see if anybody else has any other questions.
The original film started with the sandbags, but the rough cut of the film showed the very first jet car that Masato Banzai built. And here is Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yes, Jamie Lee Curtis. Yes.
And little five-year-old Buckaroo Banzai. And here's Masato Banzai.
Yeah.
No, this is Akita, Professor Akita. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Professor
that's Akita back in the day. They did release that scene.
Oh, that was the alternate opening. Yeah, I did see that.
They finally did release that scene.
The reason it got released is Denise had got a copy of a 3/4-inch copy of the rough cut from
Richter.
From Richter back in the day, we had it. So when MGM did the collector's edition DVD. We loaned them those tapes.
So we owe you. I just watched that the other day, so I owe you. Thank you.
Well, as in anything that we passionately love, for example, the Roddenberry Vault that we did back in 2016, was a labor of love. That was so much work, but we really wanted to share this amazing footage with all of the people that think like us. So when we had an opportunity to do what we could for the Blu-rays and so forth, we wanted to do it. Here's a picture of the scene toward the end, and the gentleman there right here. This is the director. That's Rick Richter. Yeah, W.D. Richter.
That's the very end when she wakes back up, and then they have the black leptoid saying, "So what?
So what? Big deal."
Like, I love it so much.
Here's another shot of Richter
talking to Peter. Yeah.
Now they had two different DPs on this film, correct?
Yes, they did. They started with They started with Jordan. I can tell you who they started with. Jordan Cronenweth, who did Blade Runner, and then they changed to Fred Konenkamp, who did Patton. And so,
I didn't remember.
I knew they changed DPs,
but I couldn't remember.
You can kind of tell, because from scene to scene, sometimes things that were shot, you can kind of tell there's a different look.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Another story about the unmade pilot. You know, we just did all these wacky things to promote it. We called our friends from the Visual Effects House Foundation Imaging, and our friend Adam Mojo Leibowitz. Actually got so excited, he said, "Well, let us produce a trailer for you." So we invited him up to our house one day, and when we talked together, what kind of Buckaroo Banzai adventures can we make purely with visual effects with no actors, and that show the range of the strangeness that you would have in Buckaroo Banzai?
Oh, I forgot all about that.
And so one of them was they said, okay, we'll build a digital jet car, but we have to use other assets. So they were producing an episode of effects of an episode of Star Trek Voyager where Voyager crashes into a glacier. So we had the glacier. So they did a thing with the jet car zooming across the glacier and then disappear and turning on the overthruster and the energy beam and disappearing into the mountain of ice. Then they took a page from the pilot script, where there was this huge potato field, and in the middle of it is a radio tower that beams potato energy into space. So they animated that. And then for the third and final segment, we borrowed a page from the first episode of Thunderbirds, and we had the spaceship down with no front landing gear, and then landing on the jet car, which saved the space shuttle. Nothing ever came of the trailer, but a few years later, someone did one of the first really viral videos, a little short film called 405, where a jetliner lands.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's a great short film.
And I'm told that I don't know this for sure, but I'm told that was inspired by the Buckaroo Banzai Ancient Mysteries. And
is wow. So cool.
By the way, if anybody go on YouTube and look that up, because it's a great little short film. It's funny, and I have seen it, so I didn't know that. So that's great to know. We have a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, somebody was asking about
you can find the Foundation Imaging trailer on YouTube. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff.
Rob Barden wants to know if the models from the alien spaceships are still around, if you know where those might be.
And I was also just going to ask if you had any insight on, because those ships were so wildly different from any other spaceship we've seen after then. They were organic. It was like they had grown, right?
They were inspired by seashells.
Like yes, like urchins maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We actually have one of the maquettes here somewhere.
Yeah. She found it.
Yeah, Greg Jean gave this to us.
So that's super seashell-esque. Yeah.
It's very fragile, but it's quite beautiful.
Neat.
Oh, that's cool.
Greg gave us one of the castings for the thermopod, and I kept trying to get it used on Star Trek, never did, but it sort of turned into, there was a alien spaceship called Tin Man.
Yep.
And you
Tin Man, that's familiar.
That's from Next Gen.
Next Gen.
Yeah. We didn't use the thermopod, but you can definitely see a family resemblance there.
Yeah, now that you mention it, absolutely.
We had the model taken around. One of our set designers, a gentleman named Joe Hodges, loved the thing. He kept trying to use it wherever he could. He used to wear it as a hat. that's Joe. Joe is Joe is a genius, and he's a great artist, and he's totally insane. We love
Joe. That's cool. That is so cool.
Yeah, guys, feel free to throw your questions out there. So I'll
they are commenting. No one's asking questions, but they are.
I know they're engrossed in the conversation.
They're saying, "Well, these other movies get sequels. How come Buckaroo didn't?" Well,
yeah. Well, it wasn't for lack of trying.
Well, as you know, Hollywood's all about the dollars, and they weren't there initially.
Well, it's not just about the dollars. It's. A thousand things have to line up in just the right way for a deal to be made, for the financing to come together, for the scheduling to happen. And our friend Michael Cassatt is very fond of saying, you're asking the wrong question. It's a miracle that anything ever actually gets made at all. When you see
how I believe that.
So the fact that Banzai didn't get made isn't, sadly, that's
crime league.
The World Crime didn't get made isn't that much of a surprise. It really should be a greater surprise that anything gets made.
Well, that's, you know, we're certainly lucky that one did get made.
And of course the supersized those fries ultimately got turned into Return of the Screw, graphic novel from Moonstone Books.
Oh, there you go.
And that's kind of a thing. I've seen that with other films and movies and TV shows that were either ended prematurely that they lived on in comics.
Yeah.
I know, like Firefly, which is one of my five favorites, has lived on, aside from the film that was made, has lived on in comic books afterwards. So we got to see some more adventures there. So that's always kind of a neat, there's always a market for that, I guess. Yeah. Thank God.
If they did Pushing Daisies, do you guys familiar with Pushing Daisies TV show, Brian Fuller? Do you know if they ever did a graphic novel? Because he was talking about it, but I've never seen it.
I don't remember. What I'm not.
After TV, I don't know. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, we loved that show.
We loved that show.
It was a clever show. Yeah.
It was fun. It was clever. Oh. And it just kind of ended.
My wife was asking who owns the franchise license for it now. In other words, if they wanted to remake something.
That's a complicated question.
It turns out that there are that the way the contracts were structured and the way that different companies bought each other, there were for years and years, one of the reasons why it was not made was no one was entirely sure who owned the rights. So finally, when decided, okay, we understand the nature of the television rights well enough, that's why the 1998 television script got made. But in fact, one of the wackier things was for a long time, the rights, underlying rights, or at least some of the underlying rights were held by a financing company called Credit Lyonnais. When they went bankrupt, there was a period of time when you could buy their library, and they understand they wanted to sell everything as one chunk. But we went in and we looked, of course. Their estimated value for the Buckaroo Banzai property was $6,000. So if you were able to get them to separate the rights out there, Buckaroo Banzai was in the opinion of whoever's opinion this was that Buckaroo Banzai was worth $6,000. And if we could have done that, well.
Yeah, they wouldn't separate it because $6,000, we would have bought it.
Right.
And we would have said to Richter, here.
Make the damn make movie.
Make the movie.
Yeah, here's your movie back. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
That's crazy.
So we have tried over the decades to get this thing made, but.
Just sidebar, Pushing Daisies, apparently according to Chris Russo, resulted in only a single 14-page comic book.
Oh. We'll have to bug Brian.
There you go. Somebody's got the link in there, so you can go look at the comments there.
And yeah.
Thank you, whoever.
Dave is asking about the Bible. You know how there's the start, like the writers have a writer's Bible. Dave is asking how is the Bible for Buckaroo? Was there a Bible? Had Earl MacRouge created one, or
I think it was all in his head.
Was it all in his head?
There exists some what they call pitch documents.
Yeah.
There's a script, and there's in fact,
We have so much Banzai stuff. I mean,
this is a document.
Awesome.
Biomedical engineering strategic information.
Oh, you can read it better than I'm. I've got it. Yeah.
This is the. In the television series, the Banzai Institute was no longer in New Jersey. They had purchased a decommissioned missile silo in, I think, in Arizona or New Mexico or someplace like that.
I was going to say, it looks like it's supposed to be underground.
Underground, yes. Yeah.
And Doug Drexler did this.
Kind of reminds me of Raccoon City there from
this. This is proof sheets. We've got five binders of these proof sheets that Richter gave to us. And it's
Mary Beth, clearly we picked the wrong people to do Buckaroo Banzai. Clearly they're not the right.
Those look amazing.
They're really, really fun. I mean,
hi, Kelly.
They've got, you know, behind the scenes. You can't see this.
They're really small.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like if the transporter worked, if James Pauley could fix that damn transporter, you know, I could bring the books and you could see. We've got like five of these things. And you know, you don't, I was given them because they were moving out of Fox and they couldn't take everything.
Yeah.
And so I said,
Denise, it's priceless. It's priceless.
That is
priceless stuff you have. There are fans out there who would just, and I might be one of them.
Well, and again, we love to share our toys. So I love sharing this stuff.
We need to create a little mini Buckaroo Museum. We need a little mini museum of the Buckaroo.
Buckaroo Gonzai Institute. Museum.
Oh, so time check. It is 7:52. We are got 8 minutes left. If anyone else has a question they want to type out, please start typing now.
Yes, there were some questions earlier. Let me scroll back. Sue and Joe.
Yes. Denise says so. I'm like, my mind is like blown.
Factor in Fibonacci sequence into the design of the ships. I'm not sure what she's asking.
Oh, the Fibonacci is the ratio of the shell.
It's certainly inherent in the nautical Nautilus shell design.
Yeah.
See, Martin's asking, is there any idea of making a book about Buckaroo?
Because you guys put together a book with all your stuff.
I assume he means about the film. It's like a not about the character itself, but I think about the making of maybe.
We did pitch a book way back when, and which would have I think the notion was it was a collection of documents and things that kind of built on what Olmec Rausch did in the novelization, and we went as far as we had our book agent contact the studio to see if it was a doable thing, and at that time Beagleman was still at the studio, or still he was still somehow felt he was in charge of it. Beagleman was convicted of
some kind of fraud.
Yeah,
and like I said, he ultimately blew his brains out.
But he said, "Of course, I expect to get paid a lot of money." Was his response.
Oh yeah. Wow. So to a fan like me, all of your stuff needs to be like preserved. Like my instinct is, it needs to be preserved. But I wouldn't even know how to begin to go about doing that. Like
That's always the problem.
That's the problem. And you
preservation
know,
is expensive.
It's expensive. And, you know, we're trying to downsize, and we've got 5 boxes of bonsai stuff, and it's in the house because they're photographs. And
you have to keep it.
We also have, there were all kinds of 3/4-inch masters on behind the scenes footage. I have all of that dumped down to VHS. That can't go out in the garage. That has to be protected. It's
fun stuff. It needs to be in a museum. No.
The thing that you really do try to do is publish it. Even though we were never able to do a book, we gave as much as we of it as we could to MGM for the collector's edition DVD. They certainly didn't publish everything, but they got a lot of stuff into it. They got a fair number of the video clips into it. I think they included the Foundation Imaging trailer, and a fair number of the pictures went in there. So you know, some of that stuff gets out.
Yeah.
Wow.
Bruce was asking how old was the idea as far as, I guess, from conception to when they actually made the film, how long did it percolate, in his words? You know, how long they...
Oh, I think a long time. I think that Olmec Rausch had this percolating... I don't know the exact dates. We have some really early draft script. But I can't remember. But it's one of those things where it did percolate for quite a few years before, certainly before the final draft was written.
And that's probably pretty common, I would think.
I think it's very common, especially with universes, you know, that are built and are contained. And have a lot of depth. If you read the book, the whole background on the Institute.
The first thing that we have, this file it goes back to 1998. I had retyped a lot of the stuff from that Richter gave to Denise for the. We used to run the Buckaroo Banzai, the Banzai Institute website for, and the earliest draft we have is The Strange Case of Mr. Cigars, a Buckaroo Bandy mystery, an original screenplay by John Texas, which I guess is his pseudonym. First draft, Christmas Eve, 1973. So that's your answer.
Wow. Yeah, I'd heard that there was some changes on the name. I think Bandy was one of the
potential. Yeah, Buckaroo Bandy.
With a title card. Recently, the Cuban government embarked upon a simple plan to destroy the United States and embarrass her leaders. Fade in interior corridor at Central Intelligence.
Oh, so cool. Rob Barnes was asking, was this inspired by Doc Savage? Yes, I believe it was inspired by the pulp comics.
I think it's inspired by the genre. I don't know that it was specifically inspired by
it. Doc Savage, yeah.
Yeah, the genre.
So just time check, it is 7:58. I do want to be respectful of everyone's time. If you guys out there watching are not watching Roy, you should be watching Roy.
You have to mention Roy's show on Fridays and Sundays.
He's going to start his multi-part look at Star Wars, because Star Wars is huge. It needs multi-parts. So if you guys can tune into Roy's show on Friday night. Does anybody have any last questions for Mike and Denise? This has been so incredible. Thank you so much. Like, I'm mesmerized by all your stuff. Like, I just want to like
look. I know. It was kind of like, it's like Doug's, you know, you're like looking more behind. And I did want to thank, John and Sue noticed that Baylock is wearing a mask.
Baylock's wearing a mask, yeah.
And hi, Baylock.
Very socially responsible. Even though he's kind of a jerk.
We're being socially responsible too.
Yes, everybody's. Good thing it doesn't go through electronic. We're all safe that way.
Yeah, we're all safe this way. And on our show, we are next week. We're going to be doing The Last Starfighter, which is another fun one from the early '80s. Yep. Early computer graphics. Computer graphics.
Yeah. Yes, that's another. It's another one of again one of those great '80s movies that was just so much fun and just you just enjoyed it and there was I don't know.
Another one you went to it before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just, I don't know. Maybe I'm being overly nostalgic, but you know, I think back and I'm like, geez, you just went and you just had a good time and you enjoyed the movie. And that was the end of it. There was no controversy afterwards. So I also want to say that if you guys don't know that Mike and Denise are working on For All Mankind on the Apple TV network streaming service. And if you haven't seen season one, you need to just spend them whatever it is for Apple TV and get and watch that.
Right now it's free, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they were showing, they were allowing you to see that series for nothing. So
yeah,
really no reason. If you haven't seen it, it is excellent. I admit I was a little skeptical when I saw the original premise. I saw the first couple episodes and I was hooked and I was blown away.
It's so, in history, what happens if Project Apollo did not end after the first few moon landings? What happens if the Russians beat us to the moon?
Yeah,
it's
cool.
It's very well produced.
Here's the answer. Oops.
Jamestown. Yep, Jamestown is the lunar base. So, and it does not get Roy. It does not get blown out of orbit. Just so you know.
Spoiler alert. Not in year one.
Not in year one. It's really leading into Space 99. Is what you're saying. So, and you guys just worked on, what was it? I just saw on the new Netflix, Space Force. So, and I just, the trailers for that just look phenomenal. I mean, I love Steve Carell.
29th?
Yeah, it's a couple weeks. So
Carell and the guys in The Office, it's a comedy, so don't expect anything serious.
Right, but the trailers look hilarious. So
it does look very funny.
Can't wait for that. So thank you for that. And of course, thank you for doing this. We really appreciate it. You know, you guys, you're, you know, everybody's time is precious. I know we have a little extra now these days, but, and we're doing this just for fun and to keep connected. And so once again, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's good to see you guys. We miss you so much. You
know, oh, yeah, absolutely. You too.
We were looking forward to coming in June. And of course, that couldn't happen. So, you know, I mean, we live in a very strange world right now, but we're all going to be okay. And
yeah, it'll work out in the end. So yep, cheers to everybody one last time.
A salute to you.
Thanks everybody for tuning in.
I will.
And we will see you next week with Captain Phil and the Last Starfighter.
Yay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.